Post show.
Yeah, I'm really happy you talked me into doing both Crime and Punishment. I was worried about palate burnout, but really contrasting the two is where it's at. You need to try them both.
I think that there's, you know, I wanted to see if there was a difference. And I think, you know, since we had them both, it, you know, people are going to say, well, you know, which one should I get? You know, are they going to be the same? They're not the same at all. So it really, I mean, if they were the same, I would have been a little bit more disappointed, but they're
but,
not really the same.
I mean, so you ranked 1 second from the bottom.
Yeah.
Do you think people should try Crime without trying Punishment? Do you think they should pass it up?
Yes.
For 30 or 23 bucks, they should pass it up? Okay.
Yes. No,
I mean, I was just asking your opinion because I have a hard time saying pass up one or the other. I think they're both wonderful. I don't think people are going to regret the Nutcracker Buyer's Remorse. And it really leave it to personal preference on which one they prefer. But I was just trying. I'm not saying you're wrong. I just want to get your opinion on whether you thought Punishment was passable.
Yeah, I thought that if you. Yeah, I don't think that Punishment is that great a beer. I really don't. I mean, I still have about an ounce in my glass. Jeff wants
I'll
it.
Take
so
it
Jeff
I'll take it.
I'll
take it off you. Why make you drink it, man?
Yeah, and I find that it wasn't all that pleasing to me, and Crime was.
All right. I mean, it just says, I'm not saying you're right, not saying you're wrong. It just.
Well, I'm right, but.
Well, no. I'm just saying it's an opinion that will help the people listening decide whether they want to drop $23 on Punishment or not.
All right. Do you want to go to Amazon Anonymous and pause for a second?
Yeah, sure.
While we compute.
Computing. All right, we're back. We've picked our Amazon Anonymous items.
Amazon Anonymous. So what did you pick, Jeff?
I picked Let's Go Fishing, the game.
Let's Go Fishing.
This is the game where you got a bunch of little fish in a spinning pool, and as they hit little things underneath, they jump up and they open their mouths, and you have this little fishing pole.
Right.
You stick down, you try to catch the fish.
It's kind of like Hunger Games Hippos. You know, it's kind of got this sort of dynamicness
to
it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like it's a lot like Hungry Hippos in the whole, it's a short, futile game that means very little.
Yeah.
The reason I picked it is we have a version of this game, not a new one, used one we bought from a garage sale or something for like a buck. And really, I wouldn't pay much more for that. This person paid $18.99 for this game. I wouldn't buy Let's Go Fishing for $18.99. But you can buy all the ones you want at Amazon, craftbeer.com/Amazon. This game is great because it's all about fine motor skill and also observing the fish and seeing where they jump up. And as an adult, you can really kick your kids' asses at this game because you can parse a lot more information than they can. And that's why I picked the game, because I can kick my kids' asses at this game because... you just know where to grab the fish.
Well, we were on the same page, probably because before we did this, we played a game with Jeff's daughter.
We need to talk about that.
Yeah. But I picked Think Fun Zingo, which is a sort of a bingo game, apparently. And I haven't played it, but I was just thinking along the same lines. Kids games. This looks interesting, and it's bingo, but... kind of a tic-tac-toe bingo. It's not as big a board, but it's for kids.
There's a little dispenser that dispenses items, like a ball or an apple or a heart. And there's words and pictures. So it's a word and pictogram thing. And you have a bingo card, which has words and pictures. And you just kind of match them as they come out.
Well, thanks, everybody. And we hope to see more cool stuff as things go on in Amazon Anonymous. So you want to talk about this thing that...
Yeah, so you're a gamer, D&D, but you've played other games, right? I mean, here and there.
Here and there.
Not a hardcore gamer. But you've heard of Settlers of Catan, right?
Yes.
It sounds... You hear so much good stuff about that game.
Yes.
And I'm like, Allison loves games. And actually, I heard a news report on NPR, Science Friday, I don't know what, about how games and rules... You know, like, gaming is good for kids.
Uh-huh.
Actually, so much so that, like, the recommended daily allowance of games is like 5 games a week. Like 5 game nights a week. Like, wow. Almost every day. It's like, so games really seem to pay off. So Allison has a bunch of games. I mean, I actually played chess with Allison the other day.
Really? You
know, she was into it for almost half the game.
Huh.
Trying to learn the pieces and whatnot, which stunned me. She's 5 years old.
Right.
I had figured chess was a stretch. But she was into, I mean, she didn't get the hoy.
Well, that's when,
the game.
I mean, that's when the, you know, some of the grandmasters start.
Yeah.
At that age. Or at least start, you know, to mm-hmm. play, not being brilliant at that
but,
age.
But I mean, she played, she. That there's a game of the Cranium Lime called Zuriga, and actually it's a lot like the game we just played, where you trade resources to buy things and whatnot. And she's into that game, and she loves it because it's for 6 and up, and she's 5. She really gets a kick out of playing the older kids' games. She looks at the game boxes to see what they're for. When it's for someone older than her, she's pretty psyched about it. So, I've heard of Settlers of Catan. I've always wanted to play Settlers, right? But I don't have a gamer group of things. You know, the coolest game I owned before, you know, now was Risk, right? And Risk is a great adult game, too. You just need some time to play it. So, I was looking around, and Settlers is too old for Allison. But there's Catan Jr. is what we got. And it's not as dynamic as Settlers. But it's still a fair amount of strategy involved with it. I don't know. Tell me what your thoughts are on the game you played.
Well, I mean, there was definitely, we played a game after it, a little.
Oh, shoot, Ladybugs game. Which is just draw the card, random chance. It's no more strategy than Monopoly, where, I mean, Monopoly can have strategy if you're choosing when and what to buy.
But if you're buying, how you play too, the rule set you choose can really impact the strategizing in Monopoly. But yeah, I wanted to play another one. I was kind of, you know, I mean, I wasn't going to be like, oh no, we should play this again. I mean, if Allison wants to play that, she wants to play it. But I wanted to play it again because I thought it was kind of interesting. But what I noticed was that Allison kind of got a little bit flustered. Little bit through it.
It was, she played a lot better earlier in the day. I think it's 7 o'clock. It was a little late to play.
That's possible too. I didn't, you know, and what I was thinking though is that there was sort of a wish that would, by me, that was a little bit more complex. I'm sure Settlers of Catan, you know, wouldn't be as popular here, wasn't it? It wasn't pretty complex. But also the idea that if Allison, started to want something more complex, she'd want Settlers of Catan, not Catan Jr. So it's sort of a double-edged sword.
Right.
You know, she'll kind of lose focus some during
I think Settlers of Catan is like 10 and up.
Yeah.
So it's just too much of...
Yeah.
Too hard. Allison wouldn't have appreciated the game. You and I would have liked it.
Yeah. If find some people get together and have a game night, I'd be more than willing to do that.
It also, you know, most of the games we have, you know, Heather's found at consignment sales or Goodwill or whatnot, gone for a couple bucks. Paying $30 for Catan Jr. is a little painful. But I knew it had a rep. It had like 5 stars. It had like 1,200 reviews and it still maintained 5 stars.
Like Cards Against Humanity. I have to bring up the Cards Against Humanity. We have to play because you will have a blast playing.
Okay.
It's so much fun. We need to get 2 other adults who are willing to put, who want to play and who want to laugh their asses off. You get 2 more adults, you need at least 4. You can have more than that, but you need at least 4 people to play a reasonable game of Cards Against Humanity. And you'll laugh your asses off.
Okay, so I overstated a little bit. Catan Jr. is 27.22, and it has 95 customer reviews, and it's a full 5-star review.
Okay, look up Cards Against Humanity. While Jeff is doing that, I'll look at my list of possible topics. There's a bunch. There are a bunch.
Oh, yeah, Cards is a little bit more. Cards Against Humanity is a full 5-star review. And it has 5,702 reviews.
Yeah.
That's pretty insane that it maintains a full 5, not even a 4.5. It's 5 out. But once you get the 5,000 reviews, it would have to be a concerted effort to really knock it down even by a 0.5-star, you know?
Right, but I mean, it just goes to show you that everybody who plays that game loves it. It's so much
fun. Let's see what the worst review is. The best review and the worst review. The worst review, the most hopeful critical review is 3 stars. Can't breathe, tears streaming down your face, shock value game with a short half-life. I love this game. Seriously, love it. I played the original with some friends. This is the original. What the fuck are you talking about? And family, and was in tears.
Well, no, they first came up with the game, and then they did a Kickstarter to make it like.
But this is the review on the original.
They came up with the game and released it on the internet.
I see.
So people could print out their own cards.
I see.
And then they released a version now that you can buy.
But shouldn't he be reviewing that one?
I don't know. but that's the most critical review is that he was laughing his ass off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Most helpful critical review.
Why did he give it 3 stars? Because
it's a short. There's a truth. If you play with the same people over and over and over again, you'll start to see things repeat.
Oh wait, there's more. Don't get me wrong. I still enjoy. It's a long review. It's probably about 300 words.
The one thing about Cards Against Humanity is even with the expansion packs and all that stuff, if you play against the same people over and over and over again, you'll start to see things repeat and it's less of the novelty starts to wear off a little bit. So that's the problem with Cards Against Humanity. But if you want to have a guaranteed hilarious 3-4 hours, however long you play, I have no doubt in my mind that Cards Against Humanity will deliver that for you.
Okay.
And as you can see, I'm not alone.
Yeah. 5,700 people.
Yeah.
You'll have to set that up, find some people to do the show with, or game with.
Okay. Did you have anything you want to talk about?
I've been watching... We talked about betas last time, right?
Yeah.
Amazon Prime.
Alpha House and betas, yeah.
I haven't watched any more Alpha House. Watch betas. The fifth episode just was released. I'm not sure which day it's released. You know, that's the one thing that stinks about Amazon Prime is like all my Usenet downloads, I get alerts like, hey, new show. Uh-huh. And then like I have to go like, oh, I got to go into Roku and figure out if there's new betas out yet or not. The fifth episode.
It's interesting that with the rest of development, they dumped them all at once.
Yeah. Amazon doesn't do
that. Amazon is not doing that. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, well, Alpha House.
And I don't think Netflix is going to be doing that with their Marvel stuff. I don't know, but I don't think so.
Okay. One of the shows that intrigued me when it came out, I think it's on USA, but I never got around to watching it, was Suits.
Right, yeah.
And I've been watching Suits on Amazon, and I've been enjoying that. Suits is a story about...
No, you'll watch that crap, but you won't watch Elementary. I don't understand.
I've tried watching Elementary.
No, you haven't. You haven't told me.
I rewatched the pilot. I don't know. Didn't do it for me. I'll try. I had to restart The Wire 3 times. So yeah,
I'm not saying Elementary is as good a show as The Wire or Breaking Bad or anything like that. But I am saying that in terms of that type of procedural show, which Suits definitely is, and all those other things are, it's one of the best procedurals I've ever seen.
Okay. I'll try it. I'll give it a fucking concerted effort.
Casey
Kasem would say.
Yeah, don't just fucking watch Suits.
But I like Suits.
I'm telling you, there's much better acting and better character stuff going on. And I mean, I haven't watched Suits. I don't know, but I'm almost certain. There's great stuff happens in Elementary.
Okay. Maybe we'll see. If Elementary's on the Roku, and I just can clickety-click or something.
You can,
but because I got the XBMC and the no big TV still, my Western Digital player can't play all the video formats. So, like, I download, like, movies and, like, can't play it. So, like, I can't watch certain movies until I get a new TV and hook the XBMC back up to it, you know?
You can't convert them? Like, use Handbrake to convert them to Roku format?
I could convert them, but then they're not going to be as good of a format as they are now. So, like, it's not very much, but, like, I've downloaded, like, Monsters University for the kids. And
what format plays? MP4?
Yeah, I don't think you can play in Matroska.
I can download MP4s and get those for you.
You know, it's just certain movies. Like, we'll go to, like, hey, kids, want to watch Monsters, Inc.? Yeah, sure. We'll go up and on the WDTV, I'll hit it, and, like, can't play this video format. I'm like, motherfucker. Because if I had a TV downstairs with the XBMC still hooked up to it, it can play it. So it's not worth...
I can also get the 480p AVIs, which I'm sure it can play.
Yeah.
So you tell me what format will play, I'll get you what you need.
Yeah, it's not a big deal. I'm going to probably get a TV here soon. Keeping an eye on, like, these close to Christmas specials. There was nothing really good on Black Friday.
That's Cyber Monday.
Cyber Monday, I was close to pulling the trigger, but it wasn't...
When did you pull the trigger?
On the gun?
Yeah.
I got it on Black Friday.
No, but when did you actually pull the trigger?
Sunday,
okay.
So Saturday I was having Thanksgiving Part 2, so I couldn't get out. I was really itching. Mm-hmm. And so I went out Sunday, and Heather let me out for a couple hours, and I went out and shot it.
Okay. You want to talk about Bitcoin a little bit? Speaking of mining.
Yeah, let's talk about this Bitcoin shit.
So, Damien was trying to convince me how Bitcoin is really cool. And he was just impressed with the technical thing. And I was, when he was talking about it, I was focusing on the economics of it. And I was like, this doesn't help anything. And we were sort of talking past each other because he was trying to make a point about how cool it was. And it is cool. It's a cool idea, cool concept. And I was just thinking, well, this is just... There's nothing really new here. You're just creating an artificial scarcity and throwing it into the market, into the same market that's already there, that's for millionaires to play around with, and it's not for us to play around with. So, you know, it's just introducing an artificial scarcity. That's what Bitcoin is.
No, there's more to it, I think. Let me throw a couple things at you, see if they...
All right.
Are you familiar with how the Bitcoin mining works and how there's thresholds and the payoff when you discover a valid proof of work, you get less Bitcoins over time?
Yes.
Okay. So, and then by a certain point, there's no more Bitcoins to be discovered.
In the same sense that there's like a gold mine and you'll get a lot of gold initially and then you have to go deeper, 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 you get less and less gold.
Right. Okay. So they have that worked into it. Mm-hmm. I don't have any economist arguments on how that works or doesn't work. But you're aware of that. So
that's why I'm saying it's an artificial scarcity, because you've introduced something that has, I think there are only 23 million possible Bitcoins that are there, and like half of those are in circulation now or something like that. But they get harder and harder to mine as they get deeper and deeper.
Right.
So the first people who jumped on got a whole bunch easy, and now it's harder and harder to get. Surprise, surprise.
Mm-hmm.
That's diamonds.
Yeah.
You know, that's instituting an artificial scarcity on something that is actually abundant, which is digital data. So...
Well, you have to. If you have currency, you can't have people just making it. You can't print.
No, I understand.
It doesn't grow on trees.
I understand the concept of building a currency. All I'm saying is that there's nothing particularly new about this other than the fact that it's digital.
Right.
It's just instituting another currency.
So what about the potential or the actual... much lower transaction rates to transact in there, because that's part of what the government agency that just put out the report, it wasn't the SEC, it was Treasury, whatever. One just caused Bitcoin to surge. They put out the report saying that Bitcoin's not only legal, but it's also a valid currency and that it's good for these things. And one of the things they mentioned was that allowing... It could disrupt and revolutionize transaction fees for exchanging money.
It allows for smaller points. I think it's down to six or seven decimal places of a Bitcoin.
Well, no, it's not just that. It's just the cost to transact money is significantly lower with Bitcoin than with Western Union and things like that.
That's only because there is not a huge apparatus around there. So once it becomes a huge, you know, as huge as other currencies, then don't you think Western Union will start supporting Bitcoin once it becomes big? And don't you think that once Bitcoin becomes big, and you know, really becomes well adopted, that there's going to be just as much transaction. Yeah, right now it's there's not a lot of transaction fees, but there will be eventually once it becomes large enough. The whole idea that it will stay like this while is silly, and it's not the way it works. This is a high level solution to what should be a low to. You know, high-level solutions don't work. Low-level solutions work. Things that percolate from the bottom up work. Things that percolate from the top down don't. This is instituting a top-down currency into a currency market. There's nothing that's good economically for people who are who are suffering through the economics about this. There's nothing that's good for poor people about Bitcoin. There's nothing that's good for lower middle class about Bitcoin. There's a lot that's good for rich people about Bitcoin. But it helps poor people in no way whatsoever. It just institutes another artificial scarcity so people can make money on currency trading, which is just, yet another of a series of economic essentially scams.
Okay. You call me Pinko bastard.
Sorry. That's just my view on this thing because, my view of all these things has been tainted by what the banking industry has done in the past, 8 to 10 years and how they continue to act like they're above the law and they can create these things. And that this idea of a people's currency or whatever is stupid because that's not the way it's working. And it's just simply sliding into the same economic places that other currencies are.
Yeah. I hear what you're saying. The gold rush is going to be over soon. The wild currency fluctuations Bitcoin's experiencing is going to settle down.
Yeah, it's going to the bubble's going to pop, as economic bubbles always do. But the people who are going to benefit are going to be people who have a lot of money, who got in early and who were there to institute this thing up at top levels. And
right, but
it's not going to add to. It's gonna support a small group of people. It's not going to support large masses of people, and it's not going to help large masses of people transact things. Even though you can make it into tiny bits, so what?
I don't think the tiny bits is the point of view. I think it's
or that right now it's easy to transact because there aren't a lot of huge businesses that are doing the transaction. But as soon as huge businesses with lots of overhead get into the business of transacting Bitcoin, guess what? The transaction fees are going to rise.
Yeah, I'm trying to think how to argue. I don't have all the details on to make an argument. I'm sure there's somewhat of an argument to be made on damn beer. Fuck you, beer. Fuck you. No, I'm done. I can't argue about Bitcoin.
All right.
Nothing that'll even remotely change your point of view that you have. I mean, I have to see how things shake out. I don't know. Costs could go up, right? The technology behind Bitcoin is pretty nice. How they do the proof of works and the cryptology, cryptography and all that stuff.
It's neat. I'm not saying it's not neat. Yeah. Okay, so I was out with a friend at a bar on Friday. This friend of mine is a relatively new friend that met through D&D. A couple friends went to a bar and he and I got to talking. He is a once a week Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows that I'm pretty staunch atheist and outspoken atheist, but he said, he appreciated that I didn't, try to force it on anybody. He said, that's not my deal, especially in a situation like we're in.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I'm going to be matter of fact about it. But he also appreciated that we could have the conversation that I asked him what he believed. And I just wanted to know what he believed. I didn't just immediately jump on him because of that. I just wanted to know. The interesting thing that he said to me, which was, I forget I think it was, I believe it was Nietzsche who originally said it, but I'm not quite sure, when you stare into the abyss looks back at you. And he said, he, you know, he found that quote profound, and he thinks that and he finds that really scary. And I thought about it, and I said, from my perspective, from my point of view, from the scientific perspective, there is nothing more fascinating than looking into that abyss. There's nothing that I find more more interesting than that abyss. Now, I'm not going to go jumping into the abyss, but I am going to measure it. I'm going to throw a stick down there. I'm going to, you know, see what I can do to measure that abyss, because I find the abyss fascinating. I don't find the abyss scary. And I thought that was
a good way to put it. Yeah. It's, I mean, I, as a fellow atheist, I mean, it doesn't dissettle me. It's curious. It's like, that shit we need to figure out. That's all it is.
Yeah, I want to know. I mean, I'm not scared by it. I'm fascinated by it, and I want to see what's there. So, and the abyss is, you know, obviously the metaphor for the unknown. Am I going to, I'm not going to jump in with both feet, but I am going to measure it as best I can and see what I can learn about it.
Is that part of the metaphor apt, though? When you're relating it back through to faith?
I don't know.
I don't think, I mean, I would say working without a net's a little more apt, but it also sounds more reckless, right? And you made it sound less reckless, but it doesn't make sense.
I'll bring
to
out
me.
This
it doesn't
time.
Carry, what you said doesn't carry for me, right? Because you wouldn't just jump in. That sounds agnostic, right? That sounds like, oh, there might be a God that might not be. And when I was going through the phase where I'm like, you know, technically I'm agnostic because I don't know. I think, you know, there, I think it's not the right way to say it, but like, what if there's a God out there that just sits back and watches, right? That's agnostic, right? He doesn't interact with you.
That's not agnostic. That's it's not pantheist.
Okay. So more
that's deist.
Okay, so but more so of the there's no experimental way for you to know or not, right? Unknowing. Agnostic means unknowing. So you can't know. You won't know. You're unable to know, right?
Agnostic is a claim about knowledge, yeah.
So unable to know. That sounds like you're curious by it, but you're not going to jump in, right? Where if you say you're working without a net, is you're not worried about falling and dying. You're not worried about being wrong, right? So atheist is more of working without a net than...
Well, see, I pull it back to a Feynman quote, as I like to do. Science is a way of not fooling ourselves.
Right.
And the whole point, Andy said, you know, and we're the easiest ones to fool.
Oh, being skeptical is hard.
So,
right? I mean, being skeptical is hard. It's easy to fall into old habits, mores, or what seems intuitive.
And one of the reasons why I love focusing on things like particle physics is, I mean, you look at like the LHC, there's a huge, you've read things about improprieties in science, people who, you know, fudge numbers and stuff like that. It's hard to, it's hard to fudge numbers when there are 10,000 people working on this thing and there's intense scrutiny over it. You can't do that. When the data is freely available for anybody to look at, and what we learn is amazing and boggles the mind. But the thing about it is that reality doesn't lie. It may throw you for a loop. It may confound your expectations and your ability to comprehend it, but it won't lie to you.
So your friend, right, he is faithful because the staring into the abyss scares him, right?
Yeah.
So it's...
I asked him why, and he said, because it makes him comfortable.
Makes him comfortable, right.
And, so, and that's a reason. I mean, that's a decent reason to believe.
Right.
I'm not saying it's not. That's not enough for me.
Yeah, but I mean, for me, it's like it's more satisfying. It's more comfortable to know that there's questions out there. Right. There's the unknown is out there. It's I don't know. For me, it's more comfortable to know that there's stuff yet to discover, to figure out.
I don't know if there's ever going to be stuff to not to figure out. But I am satisfied with there
being.
You
don't need the whole story.
I'm satisfied with there being an abyss to still look into, as opposed to having the answers splayed out. And
right.
That's.
I mean, I find it more satisfying that there is a mystery.
We're getting into weird language issues because it's hard to, I think, fully say what you want to say using the terms you're using, because it's not that.
I guess God could be mysterious, right? No, what I'm saying is, maybe I'm stepping too far away from the be a skeptic, always be a skeptic. There's two ways for me to live my life that are readily, easily, right? Like, there's a shit we don't understand. I need to fill that with something that's fairly well defined, so I'm going to be religious. Or there's a shit we don't understand. I take comfort in that science will do its best to describe that.
Yeah.
And I don't need religion to fill in that hole.
Let me ask you this, because we've talked a little bit about the presuppositionalist. Let me play a presup. Let me play a presuppositionalist apologist. And you be you. And I'm going to play with their script. And let's see what you take of it. So, I'm saying that God definitely exists, and you can't have any knowledge without God existing. So, what do you believe?
I don't know if it gave me enough to really start with.
No, just tell me what you believe.
What do I believe? I believe in what my senses show me.
Okay. Do you know for sure that your senses are showing you
reality?
What's true?
No, I don't. But if I can't see what's true, then it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is what my senses show me.
If the only thing that matters is what your senses show you, then how do you know you're doing the right thing?
From the observations I'm able to make, if I am able to flourish in the observations from my senses, then that's all that matters.
Do you know that those observations are true?
If I'm able to flourish in the observations that my senses make, then that's all that matters.
Do you care about the truth?
I only care in what my senses show me, because that's the only thing that can be measured.
Are you sure that that's the only thing that can be measured?
I believe in the scientific method, and that is based upon measurement from your senses.
Are you absolutely sure in the scientific method?
Yes.
I
have faith. I have faith in the scientific method.
You absolutely are sure that a scientific method is true.
Is true?
Does absolute truth.
No, I'm not sure in the scientific method is true. But I firmly believe, and if I can't see it, it doesn't fucking matter. If I can't observe it, it doesn't matter.
Does absolute truth exist?
Does absolute truth exist? What does that mean? I guess I would have to say no. I could maybe, without thinking of any specific example, two people observing the same thing could see different things.
So absolute truth doesn't exist?
I guess not.
Are you absolutely sure that absolute truth doesn't exist?
No. But I wasn't committing to the first one anyway.
So you're not absolutely sure. So it could be anything.
I am absolutely sure that I believe in the scientific method, which is based on observation and results from tests on observation. And if you can't test and observe, then it doesn't fucking matter.
Where do you get your knowledge of how to build a scientific method?
Emergence.
Emergence of what?
Emergence is a property of the universe that appears to happen over and over again.
How do you evaluate you're looking at emergence? How do you evaluate that?
Because atoms stay together. Matter stays together.
How do you evaluate that matter stays together?
Because I can observe.
How do you evaluate your observations?
It is the base benchmark of my being. And if my observations are false, it doesn't matter because everything in my existence is in my observation. So if reality is different from what I'm observing, I can't affect that anyway, so it doesn't fucking matter.
Would you say that you use reason and logic to evaluate your observations?
Yes.
Would you say they're logical absolutes?
I don't know what that means.
Okay, how do you evaluate your ability to use reason? How do you know that your ability to use reason and your ability to use logic is correct?
Is reasonable?
Yeah.
Peer review.
It's hard for me to play a pre-sub because you can see how it's mind games. It's language games.
How's my answers, though?
Your answer, I'm not as well versed with the precept script, but the precept will be able to guide you in a way towards the precept's goal is to say that the only way to have reason and logic is for there to be the foundation that God makes them true. So without God, there would not be reason and logic, and therefore there would not be a universe that has any order to it whatsoever.
Right. I mean, the thing I would... I'm sure there's an argument against it, but the way that, you know, the angle I would try to drive and what I was somewhat doing with you was if there is the appearance of logic in order from your observations...
And the precept would say, well, how do you know that's logic in order?
It doesn't matter. If the only thing you can measure is what you observe and what you observe makes sense, then the universe makes sense.
See, what I would do to combat the precepts is to say that what the precept is doing is they're conflating reality with God.
But you're
God.
Attacking them. You're not just arguing.
What?
You're attacking them instead of just arguing. You're falling right into their game.
No. Let me finish my point. The precept takes reality and substitutes the word God for that reality. And then... pushes on this whole thing about it being the Christian God. The precept will say that they get their knowledge. The only way that they have knowledge is from God, and they get the knowledge from revelation because God told them that it's true. And so they have that, and God told them the scriptures are true.
So I think there's a pretty easy wedge to drive there, and that is... doesn't matter if God exists or not. If you can't observe and measure him, it doesn't matter. I mean, I would work on a better way to say that if I was actually talking to one, right? But it's all about science and observation and measurement.
And the presuppositionalist would say that, well, God is outside of our ability to measure him.
Then why does he fucking matter?
Because if you don't believe in him, you're going to go to hell.
I don't
care.
Because
it says so in this Bible.
I don't care. There's no evidence that hell exists.
Well, there's, you know, the only reason that reality exists is because God exists. So that should be evidence enough for you.
There's no evidence of that.
It's all around you. It's everything. If there was no God, then there wouldn't be anything, because God makes it so things can happen. If there wasn't any God, then you wouldn't exist.
Let's play some Mad Libs. Let me replace a couple verbs here. Everything exists because there is no God.
It's a dumb language argument, but I'm trying to get to how frustrating it can be to work with a precept, because a precept will just jam that back into your face and say it a different way, and they'll redefine terms willy-nilly. But the whole point is that they're defining reality as God, and you know, and reality is the basis for all these things that we observe. Reality is the basis for the universe and everything. Reality is the basis for what we call the logical absolutes, for reason. And the reason that what I would counter a precept is that the one thing that science has that no religion has is efficacy. There's nothing that a religion has that gives the kind of efficacy across time and cultures that science does. Nothing. Nothing comes close. So, you know, that would be my argument if I were ever to argue with a precept. I haven't argued with one yet. I've seen their videos and stuff. But it's annoying to watch, because they play these games, these little rhetorical games back and forth, and they just throw things back into your face when you try to talk to them. So if I were to talk with them, I probably would never be able to get that word in enough edgewise, or they wouldn't listen to it. Mm-hmm. But you see how annoying it can be.
Well, I mean, you're just arguing with a stone at that point, right? Because nothing you can say. They have their talking points. You're not going to get them to consider anything. And we're trying to have an argument. We're trying to consider each other's arguments and come to a...
Right. And you saw that's what I was doing, was I wasn't listening to what you were saying. Mm-hmm. I was just throwing it back into your face.
Yeah. And that's what's so frustrating about it, right? Because I would want to have, we would want to have a discussion. We would want to have give and take, right?
Yeah.
If I grant you that Jesus Christ is our Lord and Savior, would you agree that it's just as likely that, and you would trying to get that take part back?
They would never do that. They wouldn't go off their script.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
They're working to an agenda, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not working towards an agenda. I am working what am I working for? I'm working for two humans to discuss contrary points of view and acknowledge valid arguments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. So if someone is a precept, ignore them, because it's just going to be that word game nonsense, and it's annoying as hell. It bugs the hell out of me.
It's just like arguing with someone who's hardline political.
Yeah, who just follows talking points, or you watch things, you know, on the news, and they was just following talking points. It's really, really annoying.
Basically, everyone in Congress.
So we had the celebrity rule of threes happen. Right, we had Nelson Mandela. We had Paul Walker, and we had Brian from Family Guy.
I think that's one. I didn't know who Paul Walker was. I look him up. I'm like, oh, he looks like the guy from that, Bradley Cooper. I'm like, oh, it's the Bradley Cooper lookalike who died. I didn't know who Paul Walker fucking was. If this all hadn't happened, and I asked, who's that guy from Fast and Furious? I would have said Bradley Cooper.
Really?
Yeah.
Nelson Mandela, was just, he was a good man in a bad system, and not saying everything he did is perfect, but you know, he was a very important person, and it's sad to see him go. Brian from Family Guy, he's coming back, so don't worry about it. Paul Walker here's what I found interesting. When it first happened, there were a couple people were saying, oh, it's so ironic because he died in a car crash. And they were saying, it's so ironic that he died in a car crash. And I was saying, it's not ironic. It's entirely appropriate. Something ironic about a guy who stars in a bunch of movies about driving really fast and doing, you know, things that you shouldn't be doing.
Well, it's ironic because he's an actor. He's not that guy. No, that's why it's ironic. That's the irony. If he was really a street racer, it wouldn't be ironic. He's an actor playing a street racer. That's ironic.
Not only is he an actor playing a street racer, but he apparently was a street racer and, you know, he did these street racing things and he was...
Then it's appropriate.
Yeah.
But he died as an actor playing a street racer, so that is ironic.
That's not ironic.
It is.
No, because... He's in these movies that glorify street racing.
It's like you're an actor who plays Edgar Allan Poe and you get syphilis and die. That's ironic.
If you in your regular life took on that persona, then it wouldn't be ironic. It would be appropriate.
Sure. Okay. But I didn't know he was... I'm sure most people that use the word ironic didn't know he was really a street racer.
I mean, he died in a Porsche GT.
He wasn't on a street race. He was driving home from a charity event.
No, he wasn't driving home from a charity event.
Okay.
He was at a charity event and one of his business partner decided to take this race car for a little bit of a jaunt and died from the looks of it going 150 into a tree or something like that. And his charity was, and it, all the stuff he did was all about flashy cars and showing off. And also, he was really into the whole racing scene and the whole car scene. There was even a quote from, I don't know if it's true or not, but I saw a quote that said, if I die going fast, then know I died with a smile on my face or something like that, because that's what he likes. So it's entirely appropriate.
Okay, at that point it's appropriate. I didn't know any of that. Yeah. I thought he was an actor who played a street racer, and then that is ironic. And probably the people who uttered the words ironic either doesn't know what ironic means or thought the same as I did.
Let's see, what else do I have here? We're hitting towards the best of 2013, but we can save that for another show. There was a little bit news in the science place about a possible link between the EPR paradox and Einstein-Rosen bridges. What does that mean? EPR paradox is not really a paradox, but it's basically quantum entanglement. And Einstein-Rosen bridges are what are commonly known as wormholes. So the idea, and one of the people who is a proponent of this idea is Leonard Susskind, who's a big string theorist guy. Very smart guy. Really smart guy. Great teacher, too. If you see some of his lectures on YouTube, there's a bunch of them up. He has a great lecture on the Higgs. Fantastic lecture on Higgs. A guy I really respect, even though I don't respect. I mean, I respect string theory, but I don't respect string theory as a theory of everything. Let me put it that way.
You respect Susskind in despite of his string theoryness. Man, I wish I could talk.
I respect Susskind extremely. I think that string theory as an answer to the questions of reality isn't true, but as a way of finding interesting mathematical ways to look at things definitely has merit. And things that come out of the study of these interesting mathematical toy models that string theory basically is can be used in other ways. So string theory has valid purpose, but I'm not a huge fan of the entirety or a huge amount of thought from the entire theoretical physics community going just into string theory when there are other alternatives, and when string theory is based on a whole lot of propositions such as supersymmetry that all the evidence is showing that isn't true. You can still twist the model and make it work, but you have to do a whole lot of different twistings that start to make it so that, I mean, the whole point of supersymmetry was to come up with an interesting way to solve what's called the naturalness and hierarchy problems of the standard model. Why hierarchy problem is why are the forces so huge away from each other, and naturalness is why does it seem to be that there are very specific these are rough explanations. Why does it seem that there are very specific numbers? Like, why is a fine structure constant exactly where it is? Why does it seem like this is just like a dial turned? The concept should be that these should be natural. They should emerge out of something. Supersymmetry was put in there as an idea to come up with a way to show that there is naturalness. Mm-hmm. And all the possible bounds for reasonably natural solutions with supersymmetry have all been ruled out. So now you have to go through a whole bunch of really, you know, extra things, and you get unnatural supersymmetric models, and then what's the point of supersymmetry in the first place? And then string theory and all, and even like things like loop quantum gravity are still built on supersymmetric models. Yeah. As loop quantum gravity.
I just Jeff. Pulled up the wiki page. Yeah. I'm like, I was going to ask, you know, okay, so string theory is dead. How about LQG? So I was just reading, make sure that, like, the top of the wiki page is like, LQG is dead. It's not dead yet. But
no, it, like I said, there are ways to twist these things, but they're, we need to look in different directions, I think. Regardless, there's this idea that, and it's an intriguing idea, but it's still based upon a super symmetric and at least somewhat stringy view on things, which is that the reason why there are, where there seems to be this connection between entangled particles is because there's actually a wormhole between them. So that's how they can essentially transmit information. I don't think that wormholes exist. I think they're an interesting way to make the Einstein field equations work. They work on the Einstein field equations, so does the Alcubierre drive. The Einstein field equations, this whole idea of, you know, people say the fabric of space-time. It's just a mathematical model. There's no actual fabric of a space-time. It's just the way that we have of conceptualizing it. So, but we know it's not correct. We know that in certain circumstances that it breaks down, doesn't work right. Same way the standard model is a model of how particles interact. We know it's not correct at certain energies and at certain ways of looking at things. We're trying to figure out what's beyond the standard model? What do we have that works in these situations, these extreme situations that we see out there? So a lot of these things that are built on them are idealized, you know, are built on idealized conceptualizations. So while I find the math interesting and the dynamics interesting, I think they get a lot more press than they should. These are not the first people to come up with the idea that there's a wormhole between them, but this is the first people have an interesting mathematical formalization behind it. But it doesn't mean anything. I can make math say anything I want. Mm-hmm. That's the fun thing about math.
Can you make it say P equals MP?
Yeah, sure. I can build a model where P equals MP. Okay. Will it have any basis in reality? I doubt it.
Right.
But it, what I'm trying to come to is that there's an abyss here. As you go deeper into this abyss, mm-hmm. It gets.
Where do you think we'll be at the end of our lives? Where do you think science will be? What's your thought? What's your optimistic thought? What's your realistic thought?
Well, hold on. Let me answer that question after I finish my thought here. Okay. As you get deeper into the abyss, as you go deeper down into water, let's say, the view above becomes a little bit more and more murky. What you thought was clear becomes less clear. As you understand these things more, you start to realize that a lot of the underpinnings that you based your original understandings are all flawed in different ways. And so sometimes when you're in the abyss for that long, you start grasping at straws. And you start imagining pink unicorns and phantoms. You start seeing phantoms where they aren't there. I think that's what we have right now in particle physics, in theoretical physics, where we have people who are kind of lost in the woods experimentally because nothing at the LHC has shown anything besides standard model, exactly like standard model. Mm-hmm. Actually, let me show you this graph. I want to show you a graph. This is not standard. This is not particle physics. This is Big Bang physics, which, again, we know is not complete. Mm-hmm. But this is a graph that shows what is expected between the theory, which is the Lambda CDM model, and the observation from the background. And that's the graphs overlaid onto each other. Now, the difference between the theory and the observation is so tiny that it doesn't show up as an error bar.
Right. It looks like one line.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the thing is that we keep doing the experiment. We keep finding exactly what our current science says should be there, and nothing about these beyond the standard model options. Right. Nothing. It's all exactly fitting on. Exactly. What's going on? We know that it's not correct. What's going on? And so we're kind of at a loss.
Need more energy. Bigger colliders.
But what if, we're doing that, and all it's showing us is everything we expected it to show, and nothing that, everything that the theory says it should show, that the model says it should show, and nothing that we thought should be there. Nothing that all of our grasping at different ideas, and that our extensions, like the minimally symmetric standard model, have shown nothing. It's just this plain old standard model, exactly like it should be. It's the plain old LCDM model, exactly like it should be. What's going on? Mm-hmm. And I come back to, nature isn't lying to us. Now, nature may confound us, but it won't lie. Mm-hmm. People lie to each other. Magicians lie to you, and they make you think things. Nature isn't lying to us, so what's going on?
Okay,
anyway, now your question was, what? So, where are we going to be?
Again, if you can't observe it, it doesn't matter, right? So I used to want to know what humanity is going to figure out before humanity peters out. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. How far are we going to get on this whole quandary before the end of our lives? Get another 40, 45, 50 years. If that.
Well, the only thing that makes sense to me is that is the observation that these things come in waves. That there's waves of discovery and waves of undiscovery. Waves of discovery.
Ebbs and flows.
Yeah, ebbs and flows. And we see that in everything. We see that in economics, obviously. You see booms and busts. Mm-hmm. You see that in population. You see that in dynamics of disease. You see that in solar dynamics. And we see that in the way particles move. Particles aren't particles. They're waves. We know that. They're waves. So everything seems to be made out of waves that oscillate. Everything seems to be things that are just oscillating. So how do we get the... So the question is not keep everything high. It's minimizing the oscillation or minimizing the lower oscillation. Mm-hmm. Or minimizing the time between oscillations. But that could be just the pattern matching part of me putting a pattern where there isn't one. I don't have a good answer for you, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But the only answer I have is the one that comes to mind initially, but common sense is not a very good ground.
So a couple small picture questions.
Yeah.
Will in 50 years do you expect string theory to be more validated, less validated, or the same?
Less validated.
Do you think we'll be closer to theory of everything or the same?
No, I don't think we'll be closer to a theory of everything.
I don't have to ask the next question. Intelligent life be discovered? How about will we have found life in the solar system?
Likely, yes. I think yes.
Fusion. Commercial use of nuclear fusion.
In 50 years? I'll give it a 70%. I'll go bullish on that. I think it's within the realm of possibility.
Flying cars?
Never.
Not even with drones and automated and autonomous?
I think Bin Laden kind of ended that whole dream. Once you have flying cars, you can have flying cars with bombs in them.
Just like you can have internet with child porn on it. I mean, same thing.
Yeah, but, I mean, people are going to be too sketchy about giving everybody the ability to just fly a 2-ton thing around that can also then be piled with explosives.
Yeah, drones will be able to have bombs on them, too.
They already do. But at least there's some oversight and control. You're not giving it just one. You're not just getting a license and being able to fly around. Now, driverless cars, I think, are something. Yeah, 50 years from now, absolutely.
What are the futurist questions I want to ask you?
He said, "Intelligent life." No, I don't think we will.
Yeah, I knew that answer. Well, we have a daytime comet. I'm sorry, daytime comet in the sky.
Oh.
A daytime comet in the sky in the next 50 years.
Comets are notoriously unpredictable. I would not be putting my lot in that one.
Yeah, what was that quote about comets? Comets are like cats. They have tails and do whatever the fuck they want.
Yeah.
I don't know. You have any futurist questions for me?
Okay. Do you see English as being still the main language of commerce in 50 years?
That's a good one. That's a good one. I want to say yes. I think there's too much mass behind English. Mandarin's going to be up there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think in 50 years Mandarin will take it over, but that's what every xenophobe would say, right?
Right.
What's your thoughts on that one?
I wouldn't be surprised to see Mandarin become so widely spread that it starts being learned very early on. And you know, if China's economic rise continues, then I wouldn't be surprised to see it becoming a much more standardized language. Okay, let's think. So other questions. People on other planets.
By the end of my life, that's going to be a romantic, optimistic thing, and we better be on fucking Mars by the time I die. I'm really pissed.
What are you going to do about it?
I don't know. Realistically, I still want to say yes. I just can't let that one go. 50 years from now, they gotta have a colony on Mars.
Okay.
I mean, you think? Yeah, no.
Can you
divorce the romantic part? You know, and actually say no, it's not going to happen.
I don't think that Mars is very conducive to human life. I don't think that I think that human life evolved on Earth for a reason, and there aren't many environments that human life can survive on this planet, much less other situations.
That's why we have
technology. I think we may have
manufacturing.
We may have had explorers there, but certainly not a permanent settlement. But yeah, probably we'll have some people on Mars set foot on Mars in 50 years. Probably. I'd give it a 60%. I can't go that much higher than that. All right. What about okay, starting to get into things that I'm pretty sure won't happen. Any type of gravity manipulation?
Nope. No. Faster than light travel? No.
Nope. Can't happen. Let's see. Okay. General use holography.
Hmm. 50 years?
Yeah.
That's, I mean, how long has it been since the internet has started? I would have to say yes.
I'm curious to how it would work. Just like without a substrate, how do you do that? I don't know. But who knows?
You have nanobots that fly around to make a fog. What?
No, I mean, there's reason to think that's possible. There's reason to think that, you know, we could do something with lasers to make some sort of off-phase oscillations and do something. I mean, there's reason to think these are possible.
Yeah, you could use force waves to push gases into, you know, more condensed states or something like that, right? Water vapor and some smart speakers to push, you know, sound waves through it. Mm-hmm. You could have it condense out. There we go. We're talking about patents and shit right now.
Supersonic commercial flight. Or suborbital commercial flight for standard suborbital commercial flight.
That's a good question. Well, while the technology is getting you there, other technology is reducing the need to be there, right?
Right.
I think it'll be common in 50 years. If you're flying internationally, I think it's going to be suborbital in 50 years. I'd hate to think that it's still 777s flying across the ocean.
Use of fossil fuels.
You hear that sigh? I'm trying to imagine a world where it's not converted over to almost no coal and almost no oil and almost no natural gas. I'm trying to imagine a world that's not in 50 years.
I can't imagine that.
It's going to be so much of the same that it's going to look much like today.
I don't know about looking much like today. I think things might become more efficient, but I would not. But they remain extraordinarily useful repositories of energy.
I would think it would have to be almost all the home charging type method of fuel delivery, right? You plug in your hybrid electric car type shit.
Well, that's for personal things, but what about, I mean, like, as far as I know, you can't make an electric plane. I think they tried, but you can't, I mean, at least right now, you can't, a fission reactor is too big and too bulky to put onto a plane.
Mm-hmm.
Although they attempted it, but it just didn't work out right. And in terms of, and trains and things like that, I guess you could use electricity, but you're, I mean, once you get into huge amounts of mass that you're moving, trucks and stuff like that, they still require a lot of energy density and a large amount of energy storage.
Trains work well, right? Because you can have the infrastructure to power it. Freight delivery. It all depends on
most boats. I mean, you know, military boats use nuclear reactors, but most boats don't.
How many more years before we start having serious problems with rare earth metals? You know,
Rare earth metals aren't really that rare. They were called rare earth metals because when they were first discovered and played with, they were thought to be rare, but they're not really that rare.
I was just reading an article yesterday on Ars Technical about how rare, you know, like the rarest metals, like in your cell phone and stuff like that, and like magnesium, manganese, are some pretty rare shit.
Some things are rare, but it wouldn't surprise me if we came up with ways to use like carbon nanotubes and stuff like that, and new ways.
There might be a replacement there, but they're talking about like today's replacements of these materials and like, you know, the top 20 most rare materials and things like that. So a lot of this green energy stuff really is going to be dependent on, are we going to hit any kind of extraction problems with getting these materials? The stronger the magnet you can make, the less energy you need to make the motor go.
Yeah, but you know, then again, once there is, I mean, we haven't really delved that deep into the Earth's crust. Once there is an economic reason to, we'll find better ways to dig for them and get better access to these metals and things like that. So
yeah, I guess if you look at it that way, there's still a lot of Earth's crust to go. Yeah. Then you can look at it the other way, right? You can look at it like if you get bombed back to the Stone Age, you know, there's no kickstarting this this Earth again. All the stuff that we can get to with picks and shovels is gone.
There's no kickstarting the society we have right now. Yeah.
You know, all the stuff you can get to with picks, you're going to be mining garbage dumps is all you're going to be doing. You can't mine the stuff we're mining now. Mining is a real theme of this show tonight.
All right, well, what, room temperature superconductivity?
I don't know. I don't have enough knowledge into that one to know what to think about.
Wouldn't shock me. It wouldn't shock me.
It's all material science at that point, right? I mean, you just got to find the right material.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a decent understanding.
There's a lot of material science advancements going on.
Yeah.
It's one of the fields. There's not many fields. I'm like, that are, you know, I think, I could have went into that. I should have went into that. But, like, you think, like, oh, everything's been invented. But then you see all the stuff that's happening with just different material science. And, like, that's a cool field. Like, that's research. That and medicine are, like, the two. Yeah. You're just taking elements and seeing what they can do. Either they're physical or they're chemical. But, you know, chemical to the body. The medical properties are.
Let me ask this question, because this is inevitable, but I want to know time frame. At what point do wires become an anachronism?
That's a tough one, because there's only so much bandwidth in the air. I've always joked about getting wireless wires. I haven't looked too much into the wireless charging stuff to know what kind of powers.
Now, it's true there's only so much bandwidth in the air in terms of delivering power, but like there are those things like power pads, and you could, I assume, design your house. Every surface is essentially a power pad. You put something on the surface, and it gets its power that way. It's just directly hooked up to the grid. So, you know, all your surfaces are just
power sources. I have no idea what kind of power, how many watts you can get off of a wireless charging station, right? Yeah. I haven't done any of that kind of that research. I suppose it's going to get there. It's kind of like we started talking about the drone thing, right? I think in 50 years, robotic 30-minute delivery of stuff you order.
Oh, that'll be. I think 50 years you won't need to, because you have a device in your home that will build it for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 3D printing.
Well, like I said earlier, what you can't 3D print, you're going to get airdropped.
Yeah.
You know, so 50 years. I don't know if you're going to have a replicator in 50 years, though.
Not a matter-energy replicator like on Star Trek, but something in every house that can build simple tools and things like that based on easy metals. I don't see why that would be that hard 50 years from now.
10 years, you're going to have... Well, within 10 years, you're going to have pretty easy access to getting stuff 3D printed. Yeah. Might not be in your house, but
yeah, you'll be able to go down to the shop, given dimensions, and they'll be able to write doot 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 and print it out for you.
Send it to Amazon. They'll print it out and deliver it on the drone.
Yeah,
yeah, tested everything.
So you know the creation of interchangeable parts without a huge amount of manufacturing problem is something to be almost inevitable, but.
Another place material science is very important in the 3D printing polymers.
Cursive.
It's already dead. Have you tried writing cursive lately?
Not lately, no. I can still do it.
I tried writing cursive, I don't know, 8 months ago or so, and I had to stop and figure out how to draw letters. But, you know, since I did that, since I, you know, took the time to remember it, I think I am... Well, you wrote 6 letters.
What do you want me to write?
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
All right.
That is not an I.
Not an I, no.
See? First letter screwed you up.
I'm thinking my capital I.
Give me the pen. I got it.
All right. You draw the capital I.
My cursive was as bad as yours, but...
I thought that was an L. I was thinking that it was that, but that looks like an L.
No, it's kind of the I.
Okay, I can do the rest. And the rest are very easy.
See, it's hard. I know what I want to write, but my fingers don't even want to do it.
Timing Jeff now. Okay.
Now I'm just going to scribble like my signature.
Yeah, my signature turned into a scribble too. I never had great handwriting anyway. So, let's see. That's already about 40 seconds since he started. Still timing.
I can definitely type faster than I can write in cursive.
Yeah. It's about 50 seconds. All right, so I'm going to use that as your eye because I'm not sure that's the right one.
That's
right.
Not perfect.
And I'm not even going to look at it, so I won't have anything to go on.
That's what I was trying to draw.
See, I can still do it. It's just horrible. I'm not a good handwriter, but...
It's as good as mine, if not better. Yeah, your eye was good. Mine was a little bit more to this one, but I forgot the little inbound thing. But, again, who fucking needs to write a capital I in cursive?
Pounded into me in elementary school, so I still know it. It's like riding a bike,
I guess. In high school, I always printed. You know, I didn't write. And I printed in all caps.
Really?
And people, you know, I've read that, you know, you can't print as fast.
Yeah, you can't. Caps.
So I've tried a couple times recently to print proper case. And actually, when I'm demonstrating for Allison, I try to print proper case. She's learning, you know, she's learning her uppercase and lowercase printing letters now. When do you learn? I'm trying to remember what year I learned cursive writing in school. Second grade, I think.
Something like that. And where you stood, I think third grade.
I remember pretty clearly third grade was multiplication.
Well, different classes.
Was it? I'm just saying the things, right? Like, I remember learning multiplication for the first time in third grade. I think, I'm pretty sure, yeah, Mrs. Altmaier in second grade was where we learned cursive writing.
Ava is 9. I mean, she's in third grade and she is learning her times table. So that sounds about right.
Yeah. In second grade, I think, is where we learned cursive writing. So Allie's only got 2 years before the school district has to decide that cursive writing is a waste of fucking time. I don't think it's going to happen.
I took a lot of notes, you know, in college and in high school, so I did a lot of writing in cursive, so it's just muscle memory at this point.
Yeah.
It's still, I still had to think more than normal, because now, to me, you know, typing on the, I couldn't tell you how the keys are laid out. Like, if you said, okay, write out a keyboard. Q-W-E-R. Yeah. I mean, I have to really think about it, but I can type anything without a keyboard. I can type it.
Mm-hmm. This
is my name.
Most of my passwords
My name is Greg. I just did it on the table because I know where the keys are.
Most of my passwords are random, so I don't remember them. But there's several passwords that are shared for work and stuff that aren't random. But if I had to tell you what the password is right now, I probably would mess it up in some way. Because I don't know my password. My fingers know my password. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing.
Well, I just think it's funny that my fingers know roughly where the keys are, even though I can't tell you where they are. I can't visualize a keyboard, but my fingers know where to type. Yeah, so you can type out. I mean, type out.
I just typed, this is my name. My name is Greg.
Yeah.
And I mean, I did a little bit slower than you, but it was pretty automatic.
But you couldn't tell me where are, tell me what the layout of the keys are right now.
give me a letter and I'll tell you where it's at.
Yeah, you can do that.
Yeah. Okay, so the layout of the keys. QRTY.
That's easy with QWERTY keyboard.
Right. QRTY UIOP ASDF JKL SEM Z. What's beside Z? Z.
Is it B?
V? X. ZX. I saw C. ZXCV.
No, B's over here. B's over there. Space yeah. Over here.
I had to peek. BNM, comma, period.
It's a lot harder. For some reason, my fingers know more than my brain does.
Yeah. Yeah. Like if you said, obviously my brain if you said, where's a B? I would went, oh, it's right there.
My unconscious brain, my unconscious ability, to, my mechanics, there's a part of my brain, the mechanical part
here's
of my brain
knows
more than the prefrontal cortex consciousness part of my brain.
Here's a question for you. Allison, who's 5 years old, will she need to learn to type?
I never learned to type.
But...
So why would she?
You did learn to type. You can type right now.
Well, I mean, I never did formal
learning. No, but you learned to type. You learned to type on IRC and doing stuff like that. And just out of necessity, it was convenient for you to learn to type. Will my children, 5 and 3, need to know how to type?
I would say yes. I think a keyboard is still a very efficient means of presenting information, particularly, and it's a lot quieter than speech, even though I think speech recognition will get better and better. Having to say everything into your computer.
I've almost never used the dictation part.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Function here, pull up the dictation stuff. Boop.
Yeah.
I've almost never used that because when I'm at work in the cubicles, I don't want to talk to my computer.
And not only that, but at least in my experience, and this may be changing over the course of time with things like Twitter and instant messaging, but still, when you're writing, it's more formal than when you're talking. And it's a little bit harder to pull out of that mindset.
The problem with the... Well, the problems with the dictation software, with Siri and whatnot, when you're typing, you have a better time to compose your thoughts. When you're typing, you almost have to compose what you want to say, and it can't be more than 2 sentences before you start recording.
Mm-hmm.
That means there's room for technological improvement with the dictation software. The dictation software has to be more forgiving of pauses. It maybe even has to let you go through some things and then say, this is what I really wanted to say. You know, there's room there for that improvement. It has to be able to let you compose verbally.
Right.
And it doesn't let you compose verbally. It only lets you dictate. And There's my second patentable idea of the night. Write some software that lets you compose verbally as opposed to dictate.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen the things in the movies. I've never actually seen it happen live, but somebody dictating to their secretary or something. So that's not out of the question. That sort of thing could happen. But I don't think.
I think there's
still
going to
be a difference between written and verbal communication.
Right, but you get there's a difference between dictation and verbal composition, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I believe so. I think you really, at least right now, you know, right now there definitely is, and I think that it will remain that way for a while. Although there are people who can do it. There are people who can dictate verbal stuff on the fly. It's a learned thing, and it may be learned. It may be more taught in the future, but for right now, I think it's, and I think that for the foreseeable future, at least for Allison and Max's future, it's going to stay that way. There's going to be a difference between written, or you know,
especially if you're doing any kind of coding, right?
Yeah,
coding is not going to be dictated.
That would be that's. Oh, I got to show you something. Speaking of coding,
maybe that's another breakthrough, right? You can have coding that you don't have to worry about syntax. You just say what you want it to do, right? And it does the syntax for it.
Go to hackertyper.net.
What is it?
Hackertyper.net. Everyone can do this if you're near a computer right now. Hackertyper.net.
Okay.
And you're presented with a blank screen. Now just press buttons.
I wrote, hi, my name is Jeff, and I like apples. And it says, struck group info, Nick groups.
So I'm just pounding on keys, and, you know, it's just, you know, it writes code like in the movie. It's like you see people just pounding on their keys, and it just starts, boom, 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 boom.
It's not very, it's a lot of the same shit. It really likes group info. Do you get group info at the wazoo on yours?
I get a lot of different. Sure. I mean, yeah, group info. Sure. I mean, it's nonsense code, mm-hmm. but it looks, it's formatted right. Just pound the keys. Just pound them. Like in the movies, like somebody in the movies.
There's not enough scrolling, though. You gotta have, like, these... Like, you gotta enter and it's, like, compiling and scrolling and... Hacker Typer. I'm a Hacker Typer.
HackerTyper.net, yeah. So I would recommend everyone go to that.
I wonder... This code is probably from something. It's probably some open source code. It's probably real...
I don't know.
Or at least parts of real code mushed together, you know? I want to compile this. Let me get the whole thing done here.
It never ends, so good luck. By the way, I think people should watch the hacker or double hacking video from, I think it's from either JAG or
MCIS. Actually, once you fill a page and start scrolling, it looks better when you start scrolling line by line. Oh,
oh no!
I changed tabs. Fuck! Close my browser. I must have Control Command Q. I was typing so hacker.
Ah, damn it!
That was fun. HackerTyper.net.
And if you get a chance, look up a video called "Double Hacking." Okay. I'll show it to you after, and you'll enjoy it. I think that's it. I think we did a How am I?
85.2.
All right.
Hot. Hot. Thanks everyone for listening to our nonsense.
Hope you enjoyed it. Oh, do you want to do a code word?
Code word?
So do you listen to that whole thing?
Electrical tape.
Electrical tape. Okay. So listen to the whole thing. Send us a tweet or something saying electrical tape, and we'll say thank you, and maybe if we get around to it, send you something. Maybe.
No.
Maybe. Not probably
likely.
Not. But
not likely.
We will at the very least say thank you, and we really appreciate it. Talk to you guys later.